This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. Coming up, the government claims that homelessness is on the decline in America, but it all depends on how you do the counting. And too big to jail, Wall Street banks seem permanently immune from prosecution. But first, the government of the Dominican Republic, which shares the island of Hispaniola with Haiti, says it's trying to come up with a formula to find out how many of its residents are Haitians who will no longer be considered citizens of the country. It's all part of a long and ugly history of Dominicans attempting to purge the country of darker-skinned people. Governments in the surrounding Caribbean have threatened to shut the Dominican Republic out of regional alliances if it does not halt its policies against residents of Haitian descent. We spoke with Dr. Jemima Pierre, a professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at Vanderbilt University in Nashville. She says the Dominican government insists that its immigration policies are none of anybody else's business.
They're standing put, they're saying it's a sovereignty issue, and even when CARICOM, the nations in the Caribbean, denied their membership, they're going on the offensive and being very angry and making threats. And so that's where we are right now.
The Dominican president seems to have plans to make it very difficult for people who are suspected of being Haitians to prove that they're worthy to be Dominicans. He's going to set criteria based on education levels, employment, property ownership, all these criteria that other people in the Dominican Republic don't have to present.
Well, exactly. And we have to remember, you know, even though we have black Dominicans who are just as adamant in supporting this ruling, we have to know this is an elite movement, the Dominican elite who never wanted to have anything to do with blackness, and Haiti represents blackness. And so, yeah, so they're trying to establish these rules that effectively will also get rid of people that don't have Haitian ancestry. So think about the poor old Dominican woman who doesn't have any papers and cannot prove that she's not Haitian. And so part of that is to try and see if we can get rid of our undesirables by calling them black. And so it's going to be completely an ethnic or racial cleansing, so to speak, that's in the making right now.
So these criteria would be applied selectively, but with the emphasis on what the person looks like, that is race.
Well, exactly. It's always about what the person looks like. That's the thing that people have to remember, because the massacre of Haitians in 1937 by the Trujillo regime was about the fact that Dominicans and Haitians look alike. And so in order to distinguish who was Dominican, who was Haitian, they had to use language. They had to hold up a parsley leaf and ask people to say it in Spanish, and that's how they could tell, you know, who was Haitian, who wasn't. You know, this is one island with the same history of slavery, empire. And so you have some elite trying to whitewash that history. They couldn't get enough white people to come in and whiten the Dominican Republic. So what they do is basically say they're not black and then try to get rid of whatever kind of blackness that they think they can get rid of. And they're going to use that to also get rid of poor black Dominicans with no Haitian ancestry. And they're also using it, the elite, to actually keep attention away from the way that their neoliberal politics have been devastating the Dominican Republic and creating more poverty for their own people.
And yet you say the Dominican Republic has been making a lot of money off of Haiti's misery lately.
Oh, yes. I mean, what's fascinating is what people are not talking about is the trade imbalance between the two countries. Since the earthquake in particular, the Dominican business people have been making tons of money through construction contracts in Haiti. In fact, just quick numbers, in 2012, the Dominican Republic exported more than $1.7 billion worth of goods through formal and informal channels to Haiti. And Haiti, in return, only sent back $50 million worth of goods. And so there's this amazing trade imbalance. And if you go there now, what you see is all the construction work, all the construction contracts that are happening, they're being run by Dominican companies. And the other thing that people don't know, because the Western press effectively managed to hide it, is the spectacular corruption charges against the Martelly regime as well as the Dominican Senator Bautista. I'm talking about Sweet Mickey Martelli, the president of Haiti, and his corrupt dealings with Dominican members of the ruling elite. And so one of the biggest corruption charges came out with the reporting of more than $2.6 million received under the corruption payments to the Martelli regime by Felix Bautista, who is a senator, who's a Dominican senator. And these payments came because the Haitian government was giving out contracts to three of his construction companies. And so they said the Prime Minister of Haiti, Gary Conil, who had to resign because of this, he started investigating eight contracts that were worth $385 million that were signed in one day, given to Bautista's companies. And so what you see is Bautista owns all these construction companies. They're making direct money from Haiti with this corrupt government that was installed for us by the U.S. government. So what you see is this elite using this earthquake as a way to make more money, as you have on the ground the Dominican elite using blackness and Haitians as a way to not deal with the poverty of their own people in the Dominican Republic.
So we have people all over the Caribbean denouncing the Dominican Republic's policies, calling for all kinds of sanctions and boycotts, and here's the president of the Republic of Haiti dealing intimately and apparently illegally with Dominicans.
Right. And the thing is, what Michel Martelly has done that actually seems good is that he wanted to have a conversation with Medina and try to deal with this, try to hash it out. So in public, he's saying he's completely against the ruling and so on and so forth. But in reality, what's going on the ground is that the Haitian elite, including Martelly, are making money with the Dominican elite, right? So he'll go to the CARICOM, he'll go to Venezuela and so on and so forth and denounce this, not too loudly, but because he knows he cannot do so when he's making money under the table through these Dominican elite, these companies and the Dominican government. So, you know, at the end of the day, what you have is you have these elites talking all this talk, making money off of the backs of all the poor people on both sides of the island.
Haiti and the Dominican Republic share not only a border and an African heritage, whether the Dominicans like the idea or not, but also vast gold deposits.
Right. And so when I was in Haiti just a few weeks ago, actually, what people in the countryside were saying is from the moment you had Aristide deposed back in 2004, they would see people, foreigners, come in and take soil samples and so on and so forth. And what we found out is actually that there are gold deposits, there's copper, there's uranium, and people have even said that there's oil under the ground in Haiti. And so then if you look at all of this, even NBC reported about $20 billion worth of gold deposits in Haiti and the Dominican Republic alone. When you start seeing this stuff, then you start wondering and or understanding why it is that Haiti is still under military occupation under the UN, the minister, right? Or why it is that the U.S. went in and caused the coup d'etat that got rid of Aristide that brought in this military occupation. And why, you know, when you look at who's going to Haiti, you know, when we went to Haiti a few weeks ago, the plane is full of white businessmen on the way to Haiti. And you have to wonder, what is there to be gained by going down there when people keep saying Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere?
You say that the Dominican elite is behind these blatant racist policies towards Haitian-descended Dominicans. But the Dominican Republic is an electoral democracy, and the president is a politician. Isn't this popular among the masses of Dominicans to beat up on Haitians?
Yeah, yes and no. And part of it is, like, we're not getting enough of all the groups that are against the ruling, all the black Dominicans who stand in solidarity with Haitians. And so you have the elite that control the media and so on and so forth having a say in that. And some scholars will say that they didn't expect their elected officials to actually turn around and do this. And so Medina's newly elected, and so people are still waiting to see if he'll come out of this unscathed. And so, yes, the elite have done it, but at the same time you also have the way that the elite has worked all over the world is to find, when people are hungry and poor and are making demands, what they do is find a scapegoat. And Haitians become this perfect scapegoat. And so in that sense, you can see how easily the narrative can work to get a lot of people on board and in support of this ruling. The other thing is, we have to remember how in 1937, the Trujillo regime worked really hard to recreate Dominican history, right? So this was a very big ideological project as well, where you effectively removed any notion of Africa from your textbooks. You forbade certain drums from being played. So what Dominican kids learned were not the history of slavery, history of black racial solidarity, or black consciousness. They learned a very skewed history that highlighted Spanish ancestry and so on and so forth. So the ideological project has been very successful in making people think they can be as dark as me, for example, and still say they're not black. And so ideologically, that's been successful. And so you do have a lot of black Dominicans who are supporting the ruling. But I would be remiss if I didn't say that there are a lot of people who are not supporting that ruling and who are trying to work in solidarity with the Haitians.
And what about various Caribbean governments? It seemed that the outrage at the Dominican Republic's actions came from the bottom, with large numbers of people in the various Caribbean countries pressuring their statesmen to say something about this abomination.
Yes, it's true. And you wonder what's going on. And PJ Patterson, the former Prime Minister of Jamaica, came out and said that the Organization of American States and CARICOM were not doing enough. They're not being outraged enough to what's going on in Haiti. And I do wonder about this tepid response. I mean, even though CARICOM's putting on hold Dominican membership was a big deal, you would think there would be some more high-level response in terms of boycotts and so on and so forth. I think part of it has to do with these countries and their own history with Haitian immigrants, right? So the Bahamas, Jamaica, and so on and so forth, you know, these countries who actually also return Haitian immigrants if they come on a boat there, and if they don't have really great immigration rulings either when it comes to Haitians migrating to their places. But I think they don't want to call out too much attention to their own policies towards Haitians. But at the same time, it is very surprising that the Dominican Republic continues to be belligerent and continues to get away with this, and then you have this tepid response from CARICOM and OAS.
And not a satisfactory response from the president of Haiti either.
He's there for a reason, right? And so the president of Haiti could be a lot more direct and a lot more angry at this situation, but more than anything, he's actually conciliatory because he knows he also knows that his bread is buttered. And so it's a disappointing thing all over. And what needs to be done is more groundswell from the bottom up, because we can't leave it to the elites to do anything for us. And as we know with Haiti's history, it hasn't been the elite that have led any kind of revolution, any kind of change.
That was Dr. Jemima Pierre of Vanderbilt University. Dr. Pierre is also an editor and columnist at Black Agenda Report. The federal government claims that the number of homeless people has declined in the United States over the past year, despite the ongoing economic crisis. But the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty says the Obama administration's numbers are incomplete and fail to measure the full scale of the problem. Law Center Executive Director Maria Foscarinas says the government surveys don't reflect the reality on the street.
The numbers really are a snapshot, and it's a snapshot taken in a way that is not really highly accurate, because it looks at who's in shelter, which really is just measuring what's the capacity of shelters, and we know that shelters turn people away every night. And it also tries to look at who's on the street, who's living in public places. But figuring that number out is really tough, and the methods that the government uses to do that are really vary from community to community and are really inaccurate. It's a difficult task, and the way that this count is carried out is by organizing volunteers in many cases in communities to go out and over a period of a few hours literally go to public places, out on the street, in parks, in camps, sometimes, you know, in woods, and make judgments about who's homeless and who isn't. And you really can't do that. So I think those numbers are highly questionable. And I think it would be a mistake to assume from them that homelessness is decreasing. The other point about the numbers is that they define homelessness really narrowly. So they set out a narrow definition. They say you're homeless if you're living in the shelter or if you're out on the street. Well, what about if you're sleeping on someone's couch because you were evicted from your home and you can't afford a new place to live? We consider that person to be homeless as well. They don't have their own home, and that's a huge number of people. And we know that, and, you know, there are reports that just came out about the crisis in affordable housing, and I think it's really important when you talk about homelessness to look at housing more broadly.
Yes, it sounds like a snapshot and one that was taken in some rather poor light. And in fact, most people, when they are in dire straits, do not go straight to the street. They do rely on family and friends.
This is correct. This is a typical pattern. Most people, when they first lose their home, they reach out to their family and friends, but often those are non-sustainable solutions. People get very overcrowded. Often family and friends don't have a lot of resources. Sometimes they get overcrowded to the point where, you know, the friends and family put their own housing in jeopardy because they go above a legal limit. So that's a temporary arrangement usually, and eventually it's no longer possible, and then people will either seek shelter if shelter's available, or, you know, move into their car or some other public place and that is not housing, a car or an encampment or a place on the street, and that's the usual progression.
And one of the better measurements, as you pointed out, is how many children in public schools are homeless, and those numbers have increased.
Those numbers have gone up very dramatically. So that's another count that came out recently, and the number of kids in public school, and remember, we're just talking about school-age children, is over 1.1 million. And that uses a different definition of homelessness, that count. That includes people who are doubled up, families and kids who are doubled up. And it also looks at numbers over a period of time. But I think it's indicative of a trend, and it's a trend that fits with what else we know. We know that poverty is not going down. We know that there's still pretty high unemployment, especially in low-income communities, and we know that the foreclosure crisis is not yet over. So I think we've got to look at this in a little bit broader context.
And one of the ways that you keep official homelessness down, just like you keep poverty level down officially, is to withhold services or to make services less available or to make service organizations more hostile to those who need them.
You raise a good point. There are also policy issues that we have to take into account when we talk about numbers, because there's a trend in many cities, many communities across the country to criminalize homelessness. What I mean by criminalize is pass laws that make it illegal to sleep in public or to sometimes to sit down in public places. And when you have these kinds of punitive laws being enacted, that's incentive for people to hide themselves. And so when counts are conducted, it's going to be even harder, you know, when you're sending volunteers out into the streets to count people who they think are homeless, those people are not necessarily going to want to be visible. And the more you have these kinds of policies in place, the less visible people are going to be. So that's a whole other issue that really complicates this effort to count. And there are other issues like that, like in some places, families who lose their homes, homeless families, are subject to having their kids taken away from them simply because they're homeless. And that's considered an abusive environment, even though families may be perfectly loving, but they're in this very bad, dire strait of being homeless. And those families are not going to want to be located or admit their homelessness. So these are complicated issues. It's not as simple as organizing volunteers to go out and make a judgment about who looks to be homeless to them.
So there are actual disincentives for the homeless making themselves known. You have some proposals, recommendations to alleviate the situation. What are they?
Well, the most important thing is to increase the availability of affordable housing for low-income people. That is the most critical thing. The budgets for affordable housing, for low-income housing, have really been slashed, and most recently with a sequester. And right now we're advocating for restoring funds to low-income housing programs. That's kind of a bare minimum, because these programs have been cut over a period of years, if not decades, and so there's a long way to go to make this up. There is a proposal for a National Housing Trust Fund to be funded at the national level that would ensure that more affordable housing is created, and we support that.
So you're talking about making people more secure in the homes, the dwellings that they now inhabit. But in this age of austerity, the hallmark is increased insecurity.
This is true. And it's good that you bring up security, because that's another thing that we are proposing and working on. And it's a very important issue this coming year. Right now, renters who live in homes that are being foreclosed on have some degree of protection under federal law. They can't just be booted out because a lender is foreclosing on the property that they are renting. They have to have at least 90 days notice, assuming that they're good tenants, they're paying their rent on time and so forth, but they can't just be evicted, which was the case before this federal law got enacted. But unfortunately, the law is going to expire next year, at the end of next year, so we are working to extend it because we think the foreclosure crisis is not over. We know it's not over. And in any case, tenants deserve some protection, some security in their homes, and some protection from the vagaries of foreclosure.
Does the proposed bipartisan budget on Capitol Hill reflect any of your concerns?
Well, it does, but not sufficiently. So, there's some language about undoing some of the harm done by the sequester, but it's not laid out specifically what funding is going to be protected and what isn't. And our fear is that different legitimate and important needs are going to be pitted against each other. So we need to work to make sure that that doesn't happen and that the needs of low-income people across the board are recognized and protected to the extent possible in this budget deal.
Maria Foscarinas of the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty in Washington. Capitalism. It's a system racked with crisis, yet not a single banking executive has faced jail time in the myriad systemic scandals since the economic meltdown of 2008. U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder this year admitted that the major banks may be beyond the reach of criminal indictment, too big to jail. We spoke with Dr. Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
What Attorney General Holder said is just the latest in a long sign of the power of the finance industry. But I should, before I go into it briefly, remind everybody that this is the history of capitalism as a system. If you go back just in the history of one country, the United States, there was a time, for example, in the 19th century when the railroads got themselves together and basically operated a stranglehold on the rest of the economy, forcing people to pay more for railroad tickets than they ought to, forcing farmers to pay more to freight their products to the markets, squeezing other companies to move things that they had to move. So, I mean, this has been going on a long time. The insurance industry of a long period of time in America was squeezing and ripping off everybody else. And that's why every one of the 50 states today has an insurance commission, because it was one way for the mass of people and small businesses and even other large businesses to try to limit, if not undo, the kind of monopoly grip on the economy that the insurance folks had. And to just pick up two modern examples, we talk about the military-industrial complex. Well, that's just another group of companies, in this case, hooked into the government to provide military equipment. And so they overcharge, and the government overpays, and the rest of us, through our taxes and otherwise, are basically ripped off of the military establishment. And the last example, much in the news these days, is what I like to call the medical-industrial complex. That group of four industries, doctors, hospitals, the producers of drugs and medical equipment, and finally, the medical insurance companies. Those four got together and basically rip off the United States, which is why we pay more, the United States, 18% roughly of our GDP, of our gross output, is spent on medical care. That's more than twice the percentage of total income in any other advanced industrial country, and is the perfect measure of their ability, the medical industrial complex, to rip us off. It's the way capitalist enterprises try to develop the strength, the power, the connections to get much more out of the economy than they otherwise would. And I think all we're seeing now is the latest incarnation, the financial industries, largely because we have become a debt economy. If you go back 30, 40 years, most transactions did not involve debts. When you went to the store to get a quart of milk, or when you went to the gas station to fill up your car, or whatever you did, you paid cash. Maybe occasionally you wrote a check. But you did not borrow, which is what using a credit card means, the way we now do, literally, for every virtual expenditure we make. And the same is true that governments didn't go into debt this way, companies didn't go into debt the way they do now. But of course, if everybody, business, government, and labor, have to use debt all the time, it puts the finance industry, basically the banks and the others involved in that industry, in a wonderful place to monopolize the access to money one way or another, and to overcharge and to gouge. And that's what they've been doing. For those folks who don't pay attention, let me also remind you, over the last year and a half, America's biggest banks, and everybody knows their names, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Citibank, and so on, have been paying $1 million and sometimes $1 billion fines for one set of illegal or unethical actions involving the following: manipulating interest rates, something called the LIBOR scandal in England, overcharging their clients for all kinds of services that either were overpriced or simply not delivered at all, laundering money, illegal crime money that they shouldn't have laundered, misrepresenting during the mortgage crisis of the last 6 years, misrepresenting to people that they were offering mortgage to what the cost would be, whether they could afford it. One thing after another. By the way, right now, there's an immense investigation going on that is certain to lead to all kinds of scandal revelations about the big banks manipulating the foreign exchange markets. You know, every businessman who has to do business with the euro or the Chinese currency or the Japanese currency has to go through exchanges where you give one currency for another, and it turns out the big banks, who have literally been manipulating everything else to squeeze more money into their hands, have squeezed that market too. It seems to me, therefore, that the evidence is overwhelming that leaving banking, something we all now need in a debt-dependent economy, in the hands of a tiny collection of big businesses who are in the business of money management to make a profit, big businesses who have shown that literally in every area of their business, they have engaged in such illegal and unethical behavior that even the government they have so much influence over has managed to force them into public admissions and to pay huge fines. I mean, how much more evidence would a reasonable person need to say leaving banking in the hands of these private banksters is unwise public policy, is terribly costly for everybody else, and at the very least, there ought to be a national debate about dealing with the systematic or the systemic dimension of this, rather than forever coming up with this little rule, the Dodd-Frank collection of laws. The banks have shown themselves more than capable to dance very effectively outside these rules, to evade them, to avoid them, in some cases to weaken them, and literally get the Congress to eliminate them. So doing more of what we have seen doesn't work is either very ignorant or it demonstrates a kind of complicity of the government with this sector that knows that to keep its monopoly wealth, it better try to control the political system, lest an angry population force a different outcome.
2 years ago, we heard calls from the Occupy movement for a breakup of the banks. But breaking up the five biggest banks into 10, would that really solve the problem? It's still extremely concentrated capital, and it doesn't break up that whole class.
No, and not only that, but, you know, to break them up simply says, okay, we're going to go back to where we were 30, 40, 50 years ago when we weren't so concentrated, and then we're going to reproduce, since we haven't changed the system, the same concentration over time. The only difference would be it'll all go much faster now because all of these banks have been through it once before and know what to do and how to do it more effectively even than they did it before. Not that I think that, by the way, smaller banks were any great social blessing either. So for me, you know, going from large to small is not only an unsustainable move and a very questionable one, but it doesn't really solve the problem of what banks do every time they get a chance. In the old days, the bank would be ripping people off in a small area, a village, a town, a city, a state. Now, because banks have concentrated it, they're doing it on a national and even international scale so we can see it more clearly. But the problem with banking is everybody needs it, everybody wants it, everybody depends on it, and in our capitalist system, when private business get themselves into a situation like that, the temptation to rip it off seems to be beyond their control. It's a little bit like the old jokes that used to be made about the funeral industry, you know, but when you're feeling really low because a loved one has died and you have to go in there and negotiate with them about the price of a casket, they kind of have you at a disadvantage. And it's a little bit like that with the medical profession, which is one of the ways they get so greedy and get so much, or the military, who can constantly frighten the people by saying, gee, you got to give us all this money or else we'll be attacked by somebody. It's these games that are played with deft political manipulation and public relations are designed to give groups of capitalists the kinds of monopoly position that they can use to do what the financial industries are now doing so blatantly. And even though it's clear that they were the key players that brought us into this crisis starting at the late 2007, even with that, they still have the nerve, and you kind of almost have to admire it, to go and tell everybody that they've got everything under control, that they are doing a great job, that they are ought to be left alone to manage affairs. They use the money that was lent to them to bail them out of the crisis, to lobby the Congress not to regulate them. I mean, it's mind-bending, and my hope is at least in some not-too-distant future, people will look back on this period of American history and shake their heads that the American people allowed a tenth of this, let alone the whole of it.
When you have vital social and economic functions that everybody, as you said, wants, needs, and depends upon, well, that seems like a demand for nationalization, that is, to make it a public function.
Absolutely. I think, you know, in a society that wasn't ideologically manipulated at every turn in the university, in the world of the media, in the political circles, to make sure that that question never arose, if we weren't drowning in a fog of ideology, we would long ago have said any entity that works as badly as big finance has, that has had to pay billions in fines because they got caught, Lord knows what they were doing that they haven't gotten caught at least not yet, any reasonable person would say, okay, one question we have to ask is whether a private way of handling finance is the best thing for this society. The proof that we live in an ideological fog is that that question cannot be raised. The basic conversation seems to be between letting them continue to do things and manage themselves, which is mind-bending that some people could actually believe that, or slapping another rule or law or regulation on them, which is a stunning ability to forget and pretend that we haven't been trying that for the last 75 years and discovering that it absolutely does not work. And if you were reasonable, then of course nationalization, and if people are worried about nationalization, it gives the government too much power, well then combine nationalization with something that I work on, which is giving workers directly control in their workplaces, and that would include banks. Make banks democratic enterprises where all the people who work in the bank, from the sweeper to the clerk behind the counter to the loan officer and all across what banking does, make all of those people together able to decide democratically what that bank does. It would then be very much harder for the banks to do things that wouldn't get out into the light of day, that wouldn't have one or two or three of those workers in that bank willing to say when something was being done that wasn't to be, this needs to be discussed, this, you know, it's a whole different way of thinking about enterprises, and it would, I think, go a long way to at least reduce the unbelievable extra wasted money that the finance industry is able to suck out of this economy, having grabbed a corner where that dependency can be manipulated by them to that end.
As you say, it's almost impossible to raise the question of nationalization in this political environment. And yet, almost everybody hates the banks. And if one did raise it, it would be, in fact, a very popular issue, wouldn't it?
I believe so. And, you know, many other countries, particularly after World War II, when World War II ended in Europe, many of the masses of people in places like France and Italy and Spain and so on were very critical of their governments for having gotten into that war, for having behaved badly in it in a variety of ways. And you had a kind of consensus that big business and the politicians had brought a total calamity on the continent of Europe. Basically, two world wars in a period of 40 years was a stunning record. And so there was a decision that they ought to nationalize the biggest industries and make them subordinate to the political will of the people through the government. And so, for example, in France, a country I know best, banks were in fact nationalized. If the United States were to want to debate that, it doesn't have to be a debate about hypotheticals, what it might be like if the banks were nationalized. We have plenty of concrete experience, hands-on experience in countries that are advanced industrial capitalist countries quite like our own, who went down that road, who have that experience. And let me assure folks that the economic development of places like France after World War II were very, very successful. They had nearly full employment. They had very rapid economic growth, much more than today with private banking. Public banking has worked real well. And to give you one final example, there actually is in the United States one place where public banking has been practiced for the last century. The state of North Dakota, think about it, organized a public bank. It's called the Bank of North Dakota. It's owned and operated by the people of North Dakota through the government. It is not a private bank. And just hear me for a minute. That bank did not have any problem with mortgage loans. It didn't speculate in all those derivatives that exploded the bank, the private banking system. It has been treasured by the people of North Dakota. They have repulsed every effort by the big banks to undo it because they don't like that model here in the United States, by Republican and conservative political attacks. The quite conservative voters of North Dakota will have none of it, and they have preserved that bank right to this day. It loans money particularly to North Dakotans, farmers, students, small businesses. But here's the best part. Being a bank, doing what banks do, all the money of the state of North Dakota, every agency, from the fishing license people to the income tax collectors or whatever, they all deposit their money, not in a private bank, but they deposit the people's money in the people's bank. And when that bank reports a profit, which it regularly does, guess what? That profit is given back to the state of North Dakota to use, and thereby allows the state of North Dakota to tax its people and its businesses less than they otherwise would, because they've got a nationalized, or in this case, state-level nationalized bank. So if we want to seriously have a debate, not only do we not have to dwell in hypotheticals about how it might work, because we have the European experience, and in other countries too, but even here in the United States, we have a 100-year glowing success in the Bank of North Dakota, which makes it even more stunning that, well, I won't embarrass anyone listening to this radio by asking for a show of hands how many knew about the Bank of North Dakota. But if a lot of people don't know, then that's not their fault. That's the fault of a repressed public discourse that is not allowed to look in these kinds of directions, which would be the obvious ones. Imagine if a public company worked as horrifically as these banks had, exposed for criminal activity, illegal activity, price gouging and fee gouging, forced to pay immense penalty fines. The cry to privatize such a state operation would have been deafening. Meanwhile, when the private sector screws up big time, the thing that's deafening is the silence, the inability of the public of the United States to rise to the obvious questions and debates which this situation calls for.
That was noted economist Dr. Richard Wolff. In the 5 years that President Obama has been in office, the United States military presence in Africa has increased dramatically. Obama was elected at about the same time that AFRICOM, the U.S. military command on the continent, came into being. Since then, Africa has become an even more violent and unstable place, according to Sarah Frounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC.
The one thing that's become clearer this year than at any time in the past is U.S. intervention involvement creates spreading destabilization and chaos. It's designed to do that. We can see the immediate results in South Sudan, a country that came into existence under U.S. protection, carved from Sudan under U.N. authorization in order to take this oil-rich region, put it directly under the control of U.S. and U.N. forces. And today, huge destabilization and chaos in South Sudan. We see the howling wasteland that they left in Libya, tearing down the government in Libya, assassinating Gaddafi. And what has been the result, though, is it has been complete destabilization and chaos. The U.S. interests that they hoped would be able to find a strong foothold there, they have not. The 35 countries where there now are U.S. troops, all of them, because the troops are really there to try to establish a neo-colonial order. There's great resistance to U.S. forces throughout the region, and yet the drone attacks are continuing, as we see in Somalia, in Sudan, throughout the whole widening arc of the region. And also, the U.S. is acting both in competition with and in collaboration with the former imperialist powers such as France and Mali and Central African Republic. A quarter of all the oil and raw materials that are consumed in the U.S. come from Africa, so securing access to this wealth is a real basis for U.S. interest in Africa. It's no interest at all in democracy, freedom, development, or any of the grand words that they use.
So we see that wherever the United States leaves its military footprint, chaos and violence follow. But you say that's part of the plan.
it's very much part of the plan, and yet it's a sign also of decline and decay on the part of U.S. imperialism, that they're incapable of reorganizing in any way at all society in any of the areas that they intervene. They can militarily create huge destruction, but they're not even able to reorganize society in their own interests. And we see that the most clearly in Iraq and in Afghanistan, where they created massive destruction, hundreds of thousands of deaths through starvation, through war, through the chaos of war, through the sectarian divisions that always go hand in hand with U.S. wars. U.S. troops were forced out of Iraq. That was a historic gain. And yet their operations of division and sectarian violence remained. The structure they left behind, the officials and collaborators they left behind continue that same policy of sectarian warfare in Iraq today. Today they're again in a struggle to keep their forces in Afghanistan and being told by all forces there they want them out, they want them gone. And the only thing that they can point to is if we leave totally, the destruction in Iraq is what awaits you. So they're nowhere really giving an improved circumstance of life, even improved productive capacity. And they have torn down the real gains that a number of countries had made, such as in Libya, such as in Iraq, of free, full health care, free education, that when these countries had control of their own resources, they were able to provide for the population. We see that their attempts in Syria, also an attempt at regime change to just pull down the existing state. Now they've created huge destruction in Syria. A third of the population there now displaced by war. 2 million in the surrounding countries, 5 million internally displaced in Syria. They failed in the overturn of the government in Syria. And that's important to anywhere at all that U.S. policymakers, U.S. war machine stopped is important. But we see what the wars bring, and that is the organizing, the pain, the training of extreme right-wing militias and mercenaries into the entire region, and the strengthening of these completely destructive forces, and the destruction of the hospitals and the schools and the social programs that had previously existed. That's their plan also for Iran. And the very fact that they have been stopped in Syria is important for the whole region, because anywhere they prevail, it only whets their appetite for the next country, how to expand their control. It's important also, even the temporary agreement in Iran on easing some of the onerous sanctions that have been in place long before Iran began its program for nuclear energy. The U.S. sanctions on Iran began with the Iranian Revolution and have been in place ever since. The fact that the U.S. was forced to even sign a temporary agreement, and we don't know if the Senate, the Congress, will overturn that with harder, harsher sanctions or not. But that very agreement came because countries around the world were less and less willing to be part of the sanctions regime imposed from the U.S., which imposed sanctions on any country resisting. So there are many forms of resistance that are happening against U.S. plans, whether it is from Edward Snowden's revelations. It's very important. Countries around the world, U.S. allies and their opponents, had knowledge for the first time concretely that every electronic form of communication, every phone call, every email, every banking transaction, every piece of mail sent through U.S. Postal Service, everything had been monitored and recorded. That information, rather than intimidating, has enraged many, many countries.
Let's talk about U.S. sanctions, which it has now spread across the world in unprecedented layers. The United States used to say that it deployed massive military force all over the globe for one reason, that it wanted to keep oil flowing freely. But now we see, with regard to Iran, the United States forcibly restricting oil exports from one of the most important oil exporters, that the U.S.'s erstwhile allies in Libya have cut that country's oil production up to 90%, and under Bush, the United States did its best to cripple Venezuela's oil production.
That's so true. Control of the oil has never been about the free flow of oil. It's always been about the monopoly control and domination of the oil markets to stop the free flow of oil and put it securely in the hands of U.S. corporate power, of Wall Street. It's not that oil can't move anywhere in the world. There certainly are the pipelines, the tankers, the oil exploration. But who profits at every stage of oil, from the exploration to the drilling to the shipping to the refining? That's what they want in the hands of Wall Street. And anywhere they can't have it in their control, they want to turn it off and refuse anyone the ability to purchase, for example, Iranian oil. That's their plan. Shut it down. Venezuelan oil. Do everything they can to take it off the market. That's what they wanted to get off the market in Libya.
So the United States isn't attempting just to control who gets to produce oil and put it on the market, but who gets to consume it at a fair and reasonable price.
Yes, it is both the sale of oil, the consumption of oil, and the price of oil. And all of that they want to control and dominate. And it's disastrous for developing nations that don't have their own oil. It impoverishes whole parts of Africa and Asia, forced into very unequal trading agreements. And it's not only oil. It's all the raw materials and labor of the world that they're seeking to control. They shut down industries in the U.S. and move them to Bangladesh, Thailand, and countries that, because of their underdevelopment, are forced to accept all kinds of deeply unequal relations. Shops and industries, of course, garment, but electronics and consumer products. Almost everything that used to be produced in the U.S. is now produced a tenth of the same labor costs in countries around the world.
And yet, as the U.S. empire enters a new year, it finds it even more difficult to impose its own dictated terms of trade.
It's becoming more and more difficult for Washington to impose, right, its agreements of trade, to get other countries to go along with it. Even where there's been a huge political investment, when you consider what happened just last week in the Ukraine. Now, in the Ukraine, not only the U.S., but also the French and the Germans had set up more than 40,000 NGOs, non-governmental organizations, in the Ukraine, employing 12% of the population. This was actually bragged about by the World Bank at the time of what's called the Velvet Revolutions, the Orange Revolution in the Ukraine. That shifted back again. And there was an effort to get the Ukraine to sign an associated agreement with the European Union that really would have been an open door tying the Ukraine to NATO, right on Russia's border. And it seemed unstoppable, this agreement. And yet it didn't come through. And the Ukraine refused to sign because they looked at what the European Union had meant to Greece and Spain and Portugal and Ireland and the lesser developed or less prosperous countries of the European Union, where it really opened the door for the banks to loot, to steal right out the pension funds and the social funds of every one of these countries. So Ukraine could see what was facing them if they signed the associated agreement with the European Union. It's a big setback for U.S. policy, because what was the role of those thousands, 40,000 NGOs, that's what the World Bank said, were operating in the Ukraine as a key force of Western policy. They were able to organize big demonstrations, that's true, to lay really hold, have an encampment in Kiev. U.S. senators such as McCain and Murphy went there to speak. I mean, imagine if that is such a thing that happened with Occupy Wall Street, where you had a lineup of officials from Russia, from China, from Iran speaking here at Wall Street. Wouldn't have even been allowed. And yet here were U.S. politicians promising support and saying to Ukraine, we will impose sanctions if you don't sign this associated agreement. The fact that they didn't get it, that is also an important example of where U.S. policy and Western policies have not prevailed. And so around the world, I think that is what the new year, what the future brings, is both an increase in militarism, an increase in repression, and yet all kinds of breaks are appearing where many countries and movements and peoples are refusing to go along.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.